Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On the program today, inflation bites again.
We recognize that rising cost of living and the prices of groceries and gas is a real pressure and stressor for many, many families.
Inflation rises to a 30-year high, 4.8% last month. Canadians are feeling the bite on everything from groceries and gas to housing and travel. So, is it time to scale back government stimulus? Why does a new report from the Parliamentary Budget Officer say Justin Trudeau's $100 billion stimulus plan is no longer justifiable? With inflation rising, is it time to rein in the spending? The finance MPs will come here to debate in moments, and so will the Parliamentary Budget Officer about his new report. Yves Giroux joins us. And sending surgeries south. Why is Manitoba sending hundreds of patients to the U.S. to get critical surgeries? Is this a sign of a system well past the breaking point? We'll ask Manitoba's opposition leader, Wab Kanew. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players.
The inflation challenge that the world is facing right now is a global challenge linked to, obviously, this pandemic and the path out of it, but also linked to significant disruptions in supply chains around the world. That's why we're continuing to work to be there to support Canadians.
The cost of living dug even deeper into your wallet last year. According to Stats Canada, I mean, you know this, but here are the numbers. Inflation rose 4.8% on a year-over-year basis in December 2021. That's the fastest in 30 years since 1991. So what drove inflation up? Well, groceries took a major hit. That was fueled by weather conditions and supply chain disruptions. Grocery prices shot up 5.7%. Gas prices, look at this, rose 33.3% in December. Canadians fared better at the pumps than they did in November when gas shot up 43.6%. Shelter, that rose by 5.4%. So where does this leave the government's response? Well, the federal government still plans to spend about $100 billion plus in stimulus over the next 3 years. But today, that figure also came under fire from the Parliamentary Budget Officer. In his study of the 2021 Economic and Fiscal Update, he concluded that the $100 billion stimulus spending is no longer justified. So should the government retract that promise? Is it contributing to inflation? Let's ask MPs. Rachel Ben-Dayan is the Associate Finance Parliamentary Secretary. Pierre Poilievre is the Conservatives' Finance Critic. Daniel Blakey is the NDP's Finance Critic. Good evening to all of you. Ben-Dayan, inflation 30-year high. PBO says no justification to keep stimulating the economy. What will your government do in the short term? I know the Prime Minister talked about childcare, but that's not in the short term for everyone. What will your government do to bring down inflation? And will your government consider canceling the $100 billion in spending?
Well, Evan, what we've said from the very beginning and what continues to be absolutely our priority is to have Canadians' backs. What also came out today, in addition to the PBO report, was the annual review of Statistics Canada. And that annual review concluded that, you know, the inflationary pressure that we're seeing here in Canada, and I believe around the world, because we're seeing huge inflationary pressures in all countries around the world, is the direct result of COVID. It's the direct result of the pandemic. And our focus as a government is ending the pandemic. I won't get into all of the health measures that we have in place and all of the work that we're doing to get to the other side of the pandemic. But what I will say is that the best economic policy for our country is a strong health policy.
Yes.
Right. And so I think
But can you just answer the question? Hang on. I just want to get the answer to the question. What is your response to the PBO saying that the $100 billion is no longer justifiable? Will you reconsider it?
I say take a walk down any main street in Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, right across the country, and look at the number of restaurants, of small businesses that are closed or temporary under lockdown. Take the time to call an entrepreneur or two. I speak to entrepreneurs on a daily basis, workers, families. People continue to need the support that we are providing, and we have seen from the past waves that the supports that the government puts in place are not only necessary for health protection and safety, but also for our economy. Our economy is doing better than most because of the governmental supports that we put in place.
Okay.
Thank goodness C2 passed before the holidays. Thank goodness that we have these emergency supports for the lockdown that we are currently in across the country.
Okay, so I'll take that you're not reconsidering. Mr. Polyev, right, the government argues, as you just heard, inflation is a global supply chain issue. StatsCan says, for example, for groceries, there was a weather issue for bad crops. There are lots of factors that contribute to it. To what do you attribute the high inflation that we're seeing?
The same thing that causes it every time, Evan.
Do you want to explain it or you want to leave it there
too
and have
dollars,
a succinct answer?
Too many dollars chasing too few goods, which is the root cause of every inflationary crisis. And I can prove that. You know why? It can't be supply chains, because land doesn't have supply chains. And yet land prices are up 20% in this country. Real estate overall is up 26% year over year, even though all of the land and almost all of the housing that we have in the market today was built before COVID ever even happened. And as for global supply chains, think about what went up, Evan. Inflation was led by food. So, for example, chicken was up 6%. Beef was up 12%. Bacon, 20%. Evan, we have among the most abundant supply of farmland of any country on earth. We can make our own food here. What else went up? Gas. It went up 30%. We have the third biggest reserves of oil on planet Earth. We can provide our own gasoline. Home heating went up 20%. We have 1,300 trillion cubic feet of natural gas in Canada. That is not dependent on a global supply chain. We make it here. So why is it that all of the things that we have here are leading the way in inflation, if in fact it's some foreign supply chain problem that is causing price hikes?
Okay, Mr. Blakey, what's your diagnosis?
Well, there's a couple things to unpack in this conversation, obviously. And, you know, I think there is some legitimate concern that not the government spending that went directly to Canadians as income support during the pandemic, but the liquidity that they made available for banks. In other words, the extent to which they created fiscal room for banks to do more lending in the early days of the pandemic, there's some real concern that that has contributed to the investment in the housing market that's driving up prices. So that's an incident of where government action may be driving part of this inflation. But it's certainly not all of the story. Now, the Liberals point to some of the factors that are outside of their control, like international supply chains. They use that as an excuse to kind of throw up their hands and say there's nothing that they can do about inflation. But there are things that they can do in the housing market, for instance. So, you know, establishing a fund so that cooperatives and nonprofits can more easily compete with some of the investors that are out there to snatch up land and buildings as they become available so that they can create more affordable housing is something that they can do. A longstanding promise of the Liberals to have, you know, that the NDP has been pushing for a very long time on pharmacare to try and make prescription drugs more affordable is an example of government spending that would actually bring prices down, not just for individual consumers, but overall. It's been shown many times we would be spending less as a country overall if we had a national pharmacare plan. So there are places where government action could help with the rising cost of living. There are places where perhaps government action has been behind some of the inflation, but it's not all government action that's driving inflation. And when we talk about, you know, $100 billion in surplus and whether they would cancel it or not, given what's going on in the economy, of course, the real question is, what is it being spent on? If you're spending that on a national pharmacare plan, that's not going to drive inflation. That's actually going to help lower prescription drug costs. If you're spending it on the things we need to spend it to meet the challenge of the climate crisis, not doing that is significant real costs in the not too distant future if we don't get about that too.
So let me just quickly give Ms. Ben-Diane, give a chance for her to respond to both Mr. Polyev and Mr. Blakey. Obviously, both are saying the government has contributed to inflation. And two, you're not having the solutions to bring it down because people are feeling it every day. What's your response?
Well, firstly, I'm happy to talk about affordable housing any day of the week. The Conservatives put forward in the most recent election a housing plan which basically revolved around a tax credit for wealthy landlords. The NDP is also talking about, you know, the importance of housing, but hasn't put anything concrete forward. We are literally building affordable housing every day. Announcements are happening every day. Shovels in the ground. What we are also doing,
just to be fair, not enough quickly enough to bring down the price of housing. I know there's a supply crunch. You and I both know there's not going to be a million houses built. There's going to be there's a supply shortage, and that will not be material to the overall pricing, as you know. But okay, but go ahead.
But we need to curb the speculation in the market, which is part of the proposals that we've put forward.
Where's the money coming from?
Let me talk a little bit. Childcare was mentioned. I know that Mr. Polyev thinks that our childcare plan and investments are essentially, I think he called it a slush fund. That is not the case. Families are seeing a real decrease in the amount of money that they are going to have to spend on childcare, which will have a huge impact on their pocketbook. But to get back to inflation, I'd also like to remind my colleagues that Canada has an inflation rate at the moment, which is below the OECD average, below the G20 average, below the G7 average, and we still have a very strong fiscal position. We actually came into the pandemic with the strongest fiscal position in the G7, and that is why we could afford to put the programs in place which have been supporting Canadians. And when we talk about supporting Canadians, we're talking about a wage subsidy, literally making sure that Canadians can bring home a paycheck. These programs have been critical to keep us afloat over the course of the last many waves, right. And we have ensured that they are available for the people who continue to need it.
Mr. Polyev, I know we're always in a time crunch, but we'll continue over time to have these discussions. You're asking the question, I know where the money comes from, but what would you stop doing? What programs would you stop if you want to stop the spending? What would you stop doing?
I'd cut the $100 billion slush fund that the government has put forward and that the Parliamentary Budget Officer recommended against today. And furthermore, I go back, Evan, normally Canadians spend $250 billion or $250 billion buying houses in a year. Last year, that number was $450 billion, a $200 billion increase. That is why prices ballooned by 26%. Where is that money coming from? Well, the answer, of course, is the federal government is printing cash and flooding financial and mortgage markets with it, and giving out mortgages that are 3 percentage points below the rate of inflation, effectively paying people to take on risky variable rate mortgages that are not only driving up house prices to literal record smashing inflation, but also risking a future housing crash when the rates inevitably rise. And so the government is infusing inflation into our economy by creating all of this cash. The only reason our CPI inflation number is lower than some other countries is because house prices are not calculated into CPI. And so the worst of Canada's inflation is not even being tracked. So the reality is much worse than even today's incredibly bad numbers show. The answer is to stop creating cash and start creating more of what cash buys. Build more houses. Produce more energy, grow more food by getting government out of the way and letting our farmers, our entrepreneurs, and our workers produce.
All right. Okay. We'll figure out how to do that. Just in fairness, Mr. Blakey, is there anything you think the government should stop doing that you believe is contributing to inflation?
Well, I mean, I think they have to stop letting a lot of the wealthy off the hook. So, I mean, when we talk about where does the money come from, the liquidity I mentioned earlier and that Mr. Polyev has been talking about is certainly one source. But if you look at another PBO report that came out a week ago, what it tells us is that 1% of the population in Canada now owns 25% of the wealth. The corporate tax rate's gone down from 28% to just 15% over the last 20 years. That's a lot of capital with very few people who own it, and they're wondering how to make more money. They've seen the real estate market as a way to do that. But as long as they're going to be able to amass more and more of the economic pie,
right,
on it, wondering how to multiply it, we're going to continue to have inflation problems because too much private money chasing too few goods also causes inflation, and it's why the wealthy need to start paying their fair share again in Canada.
Okay, I'm Ms. Ben Dayan, Mr. Polyev, Mr. Blakey. Good debates, important debates, critical debates for everyone. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Evan.
We got breaking news coming out of Iqaluit right now. The city's water treatment plant has shut down again. Iqaluit, remember, confirmed last week that the city's water was contaminated with fuel. Tragically, for a second time, the entire community is currently under a boiled water advisory. Last year's residents went nearly 2 months without being able to drink their tap water. And this is not a winter picture of Iqaluit, as you can see. The city says experts are investigating how fuel entered the water yet again. January, Iqaluit, boiled water advisory. What a nightmare. Meantime, breaking news from Ontario. CTV News has just confirmed and just learned that the Ontario Premier, Doug Ford, will announce a reopening plan tomorrow. Sources tell CTV News he will announce the reopening of in-person dining at restaurants at 50% capacity starting January 31st. He's also expected to announce the gradual loosening of restrictions during the month of February. Ford's cabinet is also considering fully reopening the province in March. Indoor dining and gyms have been closed since January 5th, when Ontario introduced the circuit breaker to curb the explosive growth of the Omicron variant. The current restrictions are in place until January 26th. Coming up, Manitoba is planning to send hundreds of spinal surgery patients to North Dakota. Check this out.
We need to look beyond our borders as well to find faster solutions to people who are living in pain.
Is this a creative way to deal with the growing backlog of surgeries, or a sign that the system is broken and the handling of the pandemic in that province has been a disaster? Opposition leader Wahb Kanu joins us next with his view. Stay right here with Power Play. So it was back to school for many students across Canada this week, but young Canadians were not the only ones putting on their learning hats. New parliamentarians took part in a crash course today on how to make their time on the Hill count. The two-day orientation session, organized by the Parliamentary Centre and Carleton University, featured presentations from the Governor General, Mary Simon, former MPs, pollsters, and a lot more. Now, one of today's presentations was from the Coalition for a Better Future. Who are they? Well, they're a group of more than 120 people with a shared view and a shared vision for Canada. The coalition of organizations is calling for an inclusive and sustainable economic growth plan. Nonpartisan, they say. But with inflation and deficit spending reaching record highs due to the pandemic, can parliamentarians even get on the same page to get Canada out of the economic crisis? We just saw MPs debate. Maybe partisanship is a good thing. It should be. We welcome different points of views. But when does it go too far? Now, let's bring in the co-chairs of the Coalition for a Better Future, the former Conservative Deputy Leader, former Minister Lisa Raitt, who's been a regular on this program and is now the Vice Chair of Global Investment Banking at CIBC. And then we will bring in her partner in this, the former Liberal Deputy Prime Minister Anne McClelland, who's now a Senior Advisor at Bennett Jones. I think she's just getting on the Zoom call here. Lisa, great to see you and hope you're well. Look, this meeting that you're talking about comes as we're seeing hyper-polarization, seeing record high inflation, and politics is, look at the last election and look all over the world. Politics is polarizing, the problems are bigger, the systems seem weaker. How do you solve big problems with those two factors?
Exactly why the coalition has come together, Evan. It's not lost on anybody that Anne is a former Liberal cabinet minister. I'm a former Conservative cabinet minister. The organization is made up of 122 organizations in and of themselves with memberships that are extremely diverse. We don't all line up on the same side of the spectrum when it comes to politics. But what we have been able to do is to figure out that there are three things that we'd like to see in an economic growth plan. And we encourage business, as well as government, as well as civil society, to work together and focus like a laser, as Anne would say, on this issue of economic growth. Because we can't have all the things we want to have or the programs we want to have unless we have the economic growth that goes with it. And it's been missing in debate, I would say, for the past seven elections.
Okay, but let me bring in Ann McClellan. Your organization says economics is not a partisan matter. It is a partisan matter, though. You have different parties with different views on how to manage the economy, different views on the role of government, different views on taxes. Each thinks their prescription is the right way to bring prosperity. How do you get rid of partisanship? Because that's what democracies are all about, two different ideas clashing peacefully. Oh, Anne, I think you've got mute. Oh, what, when,
sorry.
Hold on. We got to make sure we unmute you. We can't get solutions until we hear you. Okay, try again, Anne McClellan. All right. See?
Oh. Hello?
Here's what we'll do. I'm going to throw that to Lisa. You start answer, and we'll fix the problem with Anne. Lisa, go for it.
Okay, I just heard Anne speaking, but I would say this, Evan, in terms of partisanship, there should be partisanship. And yes, we should argue about how we go ahead and focus on economic growth. But right now, what the coalition wants to see is actually the concept of economic growth being on the table from both the government side and the oppositions and on business. And what we are planning on doing, what we have done, is we've put out a scorecard and we're going to inform Canadians exactly what is happening in terms of measuring economic growth. How are we doing? Are we doing better? What is happening out there in terms of economic growth? And hopefully it becomes a topic of conversation around tables. And it's those constituents and those customers will move politicians, public policymakers, and will move corporations in the right direction.
All right, let's do round two with Anne. Everyone can agree we all want prosperity. I mean, at 30,000 feet, everyone's buddies in politics. It's the ground war that matters. What are practical solutions to try to get practical solutions?
Okay, can you hear me now, Evan?
You are loud and clear. Go for it.
Okay. First of all, I want to go back and just clarify. I don't think Lisa and I say the agenda around economic growth is nonpartisan. But what we do say is it's bipartisan. It has to be an issue in this country where, yeah, of course, we acknowledge there will be rigorous and appropriate debate in a democracy around which policy prescriptions or structural reforms are the right ones to ensure cleaner, greener, inclusive economic growth in 2030 and 2050. But a bipartisan approach means that we all agree that economic growth is key to the future of this country. And whether it's in committee, whether it's on the floor of the House of Parliament or a provincial legislature, we all need to have those bipartisan, respectful, informed discussions. And what we're hearing from Canadians, Evan, is they're sick and tired of governments bickering and fighting among themselves. Some pollsters were telling me that they saw the trust in government go up for that brief shining moment, those few months in the early days of COVID, when governments were working together on behalf of the well-being of Canadians.
But how do you do it? But Anne, you've been on the Hill. You and Lisa are veterans of the Hill. But Anne McClellan, how do you do it? Here we are. We've got deficits of $540 billion we've spent, and there's two different views of the economy. What would your organization prescribe that you would like people to see?
I'm not sure there are two different views of the economy. I think that our organization, 122 large and small organizations from the private sector, as Lisa's outlined, nonprofit and charitable, we agree on one thing. We want whoever it is to focus like a laser on economic growth. We want to hear the language of economic growth. We want to see discussions around economic growth. Let's have those discussions about which prescriptions around talent, which prescriptions around climate change, which prescriptions around the digitization of our economy, all of which our 122 members agree are key. Let's have the respectful bipartisan discussions, three orders of government talking about these things. And that is what Canadians have the right to expect. And Evan, that's what we're about.
Well, you know what? I like it because I like to have those discussions on this program every night. And Lisa Raitt and Ann McClellan are always welcome to join us. We're a little short of time because we've got a couple live events here. You both understand that. Please come back. I think these are really important discussions. We need to get new perspectives and thoughtful perspectives on prosperity. That's what everybody wants. Lisa and Ann, great to have you. And good luck with the new organization.
Thanks.
All right. Meantime, in Manitoba, the province has broken another hospitalization record with 631 people currently hospitalized for COVID-19. That's up nearly 400 from just 2 weeks ago. Extraordinary. As hospital beds get taken up by COVID patients, Manitoba is striking a deal to send some of their surgery patients to the U.S. to help clear the surgery backlog. The province plans to send about, get this, 300 spinal surgery patients to Fargo, North Dakota. They will send those who waited over a year for surgery, and the province will also pay for the surgeries. So will this set a trend for other provinces? Is this an indictment of Manitoba's hospital capacity or their COVID strategy? Let's ask the NDP leader there, the official opposition, Wahb Kanu, joins us. Good to have you back on the program. What's your reaction to the province sending spinal surgery patients to North Dakota?
Well, for months, Manitobans have been complaining about hallway medicine, the fact that there are people sick with COVID in these hospitals across Manitoba that are bursting at the seams. But now we're seeing it get even a step worse than hallway medicine. Now we've got highway medicine. We've got Manitobans who are being sent to North Dakota because there is just not the ability to provide health care that they need right here in the province that they call home. And to me, this is the latest in a series of failures on the healthcare front from our provincial government. Manitobans who live here, who pay taxes here, seemingly can no longer trust that we're going to have universal, publicly accessible healthcare here in the province that they call home.
Okay, but what's the solution, Wahb Kanu? If systems all over the country are getting overwhelmed, what should they do? There are surgeries across the country that are being delayed. Maybe Manitoba's saying we can't delay anymore. We'll pay for them over the border. We've got good neighbors in North Dakota. Remember, they were helping vaccinate cross-border truckers earlier on. What's the problem with this? Better that than a delay, which frankly other provinces are experiencing.
Well, I think the first thing to keep in mind is that Manitoba is actually seeing worse outcomes during this Omicron wave than other provinces. We have a much higher hospitalization rate. That's probably in part due to the failure of the provincial government to take action against this wave earlier. But our healthcare system was also weakened by years of PC government cuts here in the province. So if you look at our province relative to the one next door to the west, Saskatchewan, the COVID outcomes are actually worse for the Manitobans on a per capita basis. It shows you that the healthcare approach that this government has taken has failed Manitobans. So again, this idea of highway medicine, sending people to the United States, sending people to North Dakota, is an admission of failure on the part of this government. Manitobans don't want to wait any longer to get the surgeries that they need. I understand that that is a feeling of frustration that people have, but hopefully this crisis doesn't make us lose sight of the fact that our government has fallen down on one of the most fundamental Canadian values of being able to provide universal access to healthcare where we live.
Well, if there's ever been a sign in this pandemic of healthcare systems not able to meet the capacity for lots of reasons, it's this. Hundreds of Manitobans literally going cross-border surgically shopping on the dime of the government there. Manitoba NDP leader Wahb Kanu, sir, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, a new report by the Parliamentary Budget Officer questions the federal government's rationale for continued stimulus spending. According to the government, they have met all their criteria to start winding down the spending, according to the Parliamentary Budget Officer. So have the Liberals ditched their fiscal guardrails? Well, guess what? The Parliamentary Budget Officer himself, Yves Giroux, joins the press gallery next so we can find out. Stay with us. U.S. President Joe Biden holding a news conference today, marking his first year in office. He touched on everything from Russian aggression in the Ukraine It was an interesting thing there. He said America would respond if there's a total invasion, but may not respond the same way if it's a minor incursion. You'll hear a lot more about that. What qualifies a minor incursion? There's a lot of debate about that, if it was off the cuff or not. So you're going to hear lots more about that. But he also talked about the pandemic. He acknowledged there has been challenges, to say the least, but says the U.S. is now in a better spot than they were a year ago. Now, check out how he described it.
The bottom line on COVID-19 is that we're in a better place than we've been and have been thus far, clearly better than a year ago. We're not going back to lockdown. We're not going back to closing schools. Schools should stay open because the.
Okay, so basically the president of the United States saying no more closures. That's interesting. That's happening all over the world. Governments are saying, okay, we've done it. No more closures. Meantime, they're facing a much different enemy now. It's not just COVID. It's high inflation, and it's forcing Canadians to reevaluate their spending habits at 4.8%. Inflation in Canada, according to StatsCan, at a 30-year high. But Canada's financial watchdog is now saying, well, I'm going to call into question the rationale behind the federal government's planned $100 billion stimulus plan. The government had earmarked that amount of money for stimulus spending, but with labor market indicators acting as fiscal guardrails to that spending, this new report from the Parliamentary Budget Officer says those labor benchmarks have largely been met and the labor force has returned to pre-pandemic levels. So is the pre-pandemic spending plan still justifiable, according to the report? Not. So are the Liberals... should they revisit that? Let's bring in the press gallery to talk about it. Autonomous Charles is a senior reporter with the Toronto Star's Ottawa Bureau. Carl Dockstader is the co-host of One Dish, One Mic and the executive director of the Niagara Regional Native Center. And our special guest is the man we just spoke about, Yves Giroux, the parliamentary budget officer. Okay, great to see everyone. Mr. Giroux, tell us about the report and the conclusion that maybe there's no justification to spend another $100 billion over the next number of years.
Well, in the report, we looked at what was included in the fiscal update that the Minister of Finance tabled on December 14, and we looked for any reference to the fiscal guardrails and stimulus spending, because when the government introduced the notion of economic stimulus to jumpstart the economy, it also hinged that on returning to pre-pandemic level for a number of labor market indicators, mentioning that these guardrails or these indicators would signal when is the time to wind down the economic stimulus. So that was an interesting concept on which we commented. And that was also the signal for $70 to $100 billion in spending to jumpstart right. The economy. But strangely enough, in the December update, the government was bragging about the level of employment returning to above its pre-pandemic level, but there was no mention of winding down any of the economic stimulus, even though the government itself had stated that once we return to pre-pandemic levels for hours worked, employment levels, and so on, that the economic stimulus would be wound down. So all that suggests that the stimulus should be wound down by the end of this fiscal year, so by the end of March. But there is no mention of that anywhere in last month's update.
Tana, what do you make of that? The government, they've said we've got Canada's back. That's, I guess that's the drinking game you play if you watch a press conference. What do you make of what Mr. Giroux's saying, that their own figures would say they don't need it?
Well, look, I think that Mr. Giroux and his office have been raising these questions since last fall. But the reality is it goes beyond sort of what economists think will or shouldn't happen by virtue of what the government said in its budget. I mean, the reality is a political one, isn't it? And Omicron sort of threw a wrench in all of those works. I mean, just as they were writing the fiscal update, you know, it landed and they were already scrambling then. And they've put in markers for even further spending that we haven't heard detailed to deal with the Omicron and ongoing pandemic waves. So look, I think this is a very political calculation. That'll be really interesting. The government is already consumed by discussions pre-budget in advance of this spring's budget about how they're going to do this. Are they going to wind down stimulus? I didn't hear that from the Prime Minister today. And, you know, I doubt we're going to hear it anytime soon from the minister. They still are hewing to their promises, like their huge ticket promises, like on childcare.
Yeah. Yeah, and Carl, your thought on that. Maybe they're happy that they didn't because Omicron has extended and maybe transformed their original forecast for the worse.
And I think that's what happened, was the unpredictability of the Omicron virus has really put the Liberals in a position where they don't want to appear as if they're taking money out of the economy. Some things are being shut down. Canada is still taking a stronger approach when it comes to having a shutdown. So I think that right now it comes down to they're not going to be necessarily punished right now for continuing this spending. And the spending is popular in a lot of circles.
Mr. Giroux, does the, like, let's talk about inflation and refract it through the Omicron lens, the new reality. Every month there's another change in the economy because of things like Omicron. What about the inflation? What does that do to their books and their predictions that go back to the fiscal update that you analyzed?
Well, the inflation resurgence that we're seeing could throw a monkey's wrench into the economic recovery, but it also suggests that the interest rates that the Bank of Canada will be increasing might go up faster and might go up sooner than anybody had anticipated. With all the pressure that's on the Bank of Canada right now to tame inflation, the fact that the government is not winding down economic stimulus puts small additional pressure on these inflation numbers. So it doesn't make the job of the Bank of Canada any easier. And as alluded to, it could affect the government's bottom line. Mm-hmm. If interest rates go up faster than anybody anticipated, that would drive up debt servicing costs. And, mm-hmm. and that could have a significant implication considering the amount of debt that has been accumulated over the last 2 years to fight the pandemic. So lots of uncertainty for fiscal projections for the government as it gets ready to table a budget in the next couple of months, but also for many sectors of the economy that could be facing higher interest rates.
Yeah, and Tana, could be, by the way, an interest rate at least a couple basis points next week when they make that announcement. But Tana, we're talking about inflation a lot today with that, and let's just talk about the politics of that. What do you make of the Liberals' response? It's a global issue. It's COVID. It's a supply chain issue. And then the Conservatives are saying, no, it's you flooded the market with your big spending, and that's causing it. How do you refract the political debate around it?
Look, I think this is a debate that, A, we've heard for the last 6 weeks intensifying, and we're going to hear over the next several months even grow stronger. It's the Conservatives view it as a winner for them. They get to slam the Trudeau government for what they deem excess spending, and also speak to pocketbook issues. Politically, it seems like a winner for them. Politically, it's a difficult one for the Liberal government because trying to explain inflation and its myriad causes is a really complex issue, and you can't just stick it on a bumper sticker. So, you know, good luck. They have got some of their very best communicators on it, though. So we'll see. I mean, Freeland's going to be challenged over the next couple of months, I think, to deal with all these questions.
Yeah, definitely. Carl, your view on that, on the politics of that debate and maybe how potentially dangerous that. I mean, look, for any government who takes credit for good economies, when there's inflation, that's political kryptonite.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. But I mean, to speak to Tonda's point, the Liberals are going to have a hard time explaining inflation. But the Conservatives are going to have a hard time selling to Canadians why the Liberals are at fault for inflation. Inflation is a complex economic issue. And there aren't a lot of people sitting there with abacus is sort of figuring out which party scored which points for what exactly is happening with the complexities of the economy.
Lots of people understand their mortgages. And if interest rates start to rise and people start having trouble on that end, you know, I think a lot of the complexities will sort of, you know, be the last thing people will be worried about. And they'll be very worried about their own budget and their own ability to cushion the inflationary blows.
And I think that's fair, but housing prices have been going up for the better part of this generation now. And it hasn't been something that, I mean, yeah. Pierre Poilievre has tried to stick it to this government and it hasn't been effective yet.
Well, you don't need an economics degree to find out what inflation feels like when you go to the grocery store or the pump right now. And as gosh, if all politics, you feel it in your pocketbook first. Okay, I got to take a break now. Hang in there, folks. That is, of course, your Parliamentary Budget Officer, Yves Giroux. Mr. Giroux, love having you on the program, as always, and I really appreciate your report today. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up, keep rocking in the free world. Well, that's been Jagmeet Singh's motto. After a rocking chair rocks Jagmeet Singh's start of the year, will this blow up to be a bigger issue for the NDP leader? And will the parliamentary ethics rules be updated for the world of Instagram? We'll talk about that picture and the implications of it next with PowerPlay. Stay with us. A rocking chair, rocking the NDP leader's boat. Now, this isn't just any rocking chair. Jagmeet Singh's wife accepted a $1,895 rocking chair from Monty Design. I should say this story was first broken by our colleagues at the CBC. Mr. Singh posted a picture on Instagram that tagged the company. Remember, his wife apparently is an influencer. She didn't post it, but he did. And check out what he said. He said, you know, here I am. By the way, congratulations, he's got his new baby. I'm spending time these days. This is how I'm doing it. Mr. Singh's office gave us a statement when we asked for it. They said this: Jagmeet and Gurkaran love finding Canadian companies to support, from the furniture they have in their home to the clothes they wear. They're proud to support Canadian companies and Canadian workers. The chair was given to Gurkaran. There was no expectation that Jagmeet would post about it. That being said, while they're extremely grateful, they realized their error and have paid for the chair. We're working with the ethics commissioner, as we always do, to ensure that any gifts received are declared and that we are in compliance with the act. Is this an ethics breach, though? Tana McCharles, senior reporter of the Toronto Star, and Carl Dockstader, host of One Dish, One Mic, are back. Tonda, look, conflict of interest code for members of the House says that MPs and their families cannot accept gifts that can be reasonably seen to have given influence to influence the MP. Is this a problem for Mr. Singh?
Well, look, I think the ethics commissioner will have to parse whether there was an intent to influence Mr. Singh. There was certainly an intent to influence sales of the rocker. And honestly, there's no gray area here. It's really, I think, just such a dumb move by them. But, you know, that said, you're right. The ethics, is the ethics code up to the age of Instagram? I don't know. But I think there's, you know, we had a discussion in our office about this virtually today. Like, there's also this, the tendency that the NDP leader, Mr. Singh, and others, frankly, other politicians have, about branding themselves on social media and themselves above their party. I really wondered what Charlie Angus and other NDP caucus members thought of Mr. Singh's posting of that thing and the whole mess he's gotten himself into. It cuts the legs out from under their own criticisms of other politicians for this kind of thing.
Well, that may be exactly it. I mean, you're trying to hold Mr. Trudeau and the government to account. Carl, does this undermine it when Mr. Singh's wife is given an $1,800 rocking chair and then he goes and Instagrams about it? We have no idea what his intention is, but, you know, the appearance is what it is.
Yeah, I think that Jagmeet got caught here a little bit. I think that Jagmeet is doing a good job branding himself as a different kind of politician, but there are still those old rules of Ottawa that Jagmeet has been on the outside of, but maybe not the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. Anyways, Jagmeet found himself on the outside of it, and I think it's a mistake. I don't know how much lasting power this will have, though.
Yeah, I don't know either. It kind of is interesting. Look, I want to move over to a poll from Maru Public Opinion on another issue. So let's see what happens with that. Tonda, it was on unvaccinated Canadians. I spoke to the pollster John Wright on this. And among many things, like two-thirds of Canadians, according to this poll, support, get this, mandatory vaccinations. No one's making mandatory vaccinations, but one in four respondents support jail time of 5 days for the unvaccinated. 27% said it would be acceptable for unvaccinated Canadians to spend up to 5 days in jail. I mean, it says something about the country, Tonda. And it cuts, I think, they're both ways. What do you make
good.
Of it?
Nothing good. It says nothing good about how divided this is and how politicized it is and how awfully, I think, polarized the debate over vaccinations has become. And look, I mean, it's frustrating. I get it. But I really myself don't. I feel nothing but I feel very sad and angry that our politicians haven't figured out a way to get to persuade vaccine hesitant or vaccine resistant people to get the shot. Are we out of options now? Is that it? Like, do we have no other tools other than sticks and punishment? Do we not have any way to constructively speak to people, address them, go to where they are and address their concerns? I'm baffled by it.
Carl, 2 years in, and you tell me from the front lines, like a lot of people are saying, I'm sick of having my surgery delayed when there's a disproportionate number of the unvaccinated in ICUs and hospital beds, and we're paying the price, those people who got vaccinated. And yet, boy, that poll reveals a level of polarization that's downright unnerving.
That's what's tough, though, is I think it's misplaced. There were problems with the healthcare system before COVID-19 happened. You would think that maybe COVID-19 would present an opportunity to look at capacity, the number of hospital beds per Canadian. But instead, yeah, we're really getting into this kind of divisive politics and this blame game. And it's not going to help. It's not going to get people that don't want to get vaccinated to get vaccinated.
Are you just quickly, I got a couple, are you seeing that frustration where you are in the job that you have, Carl?
I think that the soft-handed approach works. I mean, we've been pretty patient with members of our community to share information, to share science, to work with the government directly as the Friendship Center. There's been great cooperation on that level, and I think that's effective, but it's slow, and it doesn't make a really cool headline.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to be patient. Tonda, Carl, great to have both of you on the program. Let's hope we don't give in to these all these kind of divisions. That is your Power Play Day in Politics. Thank you so much for watching. We will be back here in 23 short hours. As I always say, hug your loved ones. We hope it is safe to do so. We hope we're all together soon. Have a great evening. See you soon.